Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa Wilkie. Host Elise Max and Pat Bartholomew talk with Rick Stack, co-producer of In the Executioner's Shadow, about the film that takes a penetrating look at the consequences of the death penalty through three powerful stories. Then, host Margot Patterson talks with James Kilgore, project director of Challenging E-Carceration, about why electronic monitoring is just another form of mass incarceration, its growing use in corrections and immigration enforcement, and how the media can challenge this trend. Stay tuned for the 420 Drug War News at the end of the broadcast. We want to thank our engineer, Keith Washburn. Now to Elise, Pat, and Rick.
Good morning. This is Pat Bartholomew. We're here on Jaws of Justice this morning to talk about the death penalty. And my background is that I was with the Death Penalty Litigation Clinic for a long time, and I'm here joining as a co-host is Elise Max, who's the executive director of the Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. And with us is Richard Stack, who Elise is going to introduce.
Rick Stack is here with us today. He is the co-producer of a new documentary, In the Executioner's Shadow. Rick is the author of Grave Injustice and Dead Wrong. He's an activist and a communications professor working to end the death penalty. We're very glad to have you in the studio with us today, Rick. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I'll just give you a little overview of the movie before Rick starts talking about it. It's an award-winning movie called In the Executioner's Shadow. And it's three powerful stories, kind of a rare perspective of a former state executioner who comes within days of executing an innocent man, a Boston Marathon bombing victim who struggles with to decide what justice really means, and the parents of a murder victim who chooses to fight for the life of their daughter's killers. So I'm going to start off just by saying, why these stories in particular, Rick?
We were looking for a balanced approach to this topic, and I'm going to put air quotes around the word balanced. We wanted to get someone who was supportive of the death penalty, someone who was opposed, and someone who sort of represents a fulcrum between the two stories. There are many, many stories, obviously, that could be chosen for such a film, such a documentary. I know a couple of the people, before we asked them to join us. Karen from Boston was not known to either myself or Maggie Stogner, the co-producer of this documentary. But we knew that they were powerful stories. We knew that they would represent how this punishment in our society is destructive, how it affects lives in different, powerful, destructive ways. And so we thought it would help illustrate the larger point of putting a human face on this issue that no one wants to think about.
Well, and I think that's one of the fascinating things about this, that how people changed through the course of the movie. All of these three people clearly, after realizing that they were dealing with human beings, comes to a different place by the end of the story. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the central themes, is putting a human face on the defendant.
Yes. Thurgood Marshall, I'm paraphrasing now, but one of his thoughts towards capital punishment was, the more people know about it, the less they're going to be supportive of it. So I think education is the key to changing hearts and minds. The balanced approach was meant to be respectful, get people listening and thinking and talking about the perspective that they might not come into this debate with in the first place, but getting them to kind of scratch their heads and say, hey, I never thought of it that way. I never saw the issue in the way that you do. And so not only are we trying to address the death penalty, but we're also hoping that this approach that we've taken could be a model for dealing with polarizing issues.
I was just curious, Rick, were you also the cinematographers for this movie?
No. I'm the subject matter expert.
Okay.
I give Maggie Stogner, who is also a professor at American University. She works in film and video and is a documentary filmmaker. I give her complete credit for the visual storytelling.
Right. Well, this was such a powerful opening when you see Jerry walking down a very dark and a grimly lit hallway of surrounded by cells, and he starts his story. I mean, this starts with Jerry Givens, which is sort of an amazing, I don't think most of us look at how this impacts the people who actually delivered the death penalty.
Right. He became our title character. We didn't start out to tell his story, but it was so powerful, so unusual. As you say, nobody gets to talk to the person who's at the end of the line of an execution enforcing the state's regulations. But that first scene also, a little background, backstory there. We rented space in America's oldest penitentiary up in Philadelphia. It's not where Jerry did his business, but it conveys the darkness and the eeriness of what a penitentiary is all about. And that scene, I agree with you, I think it's very impactful, and largely because of the spookiness of the location.
Right. And then Jerry starts talking about just how many executions he had actually been part of, which I was just, and in fact, that the first part of his life was served as when executions were still in vogue and being used. And I thought that was very impactful.
62 in 17 years.
Yeah, it's hard to believe the kind of human cost that must do for, I mean, how that would impact you, seeing 62 people electrocuted, because I have to think that, well, obviously we know that the reason that lethal injections were, you know, became in vogue was because of the methods of being used that were so heinous.
Supposedly more humane, but part of I think the impact that Jerry makes is the matter-of-fact nature, the way he talks about the difference between when he electrocuted inmates and then the shift went to lethal injection. And from his perspective, it was harder on him to do the lethal injection because he was more connected to the condemned inmate. Jerry's perspective is highly unusual and shows a destructive side to the death penalty. As you point out, people don't think about. There's something else little nuance here that I think comes across in the documentary. Jerry could not tell his family about what he did. He couldn't share this with his wife. His family knew that he was a prison guard.
Right.
But they didn't know he was on the execution team. That was something that needed to be kept secret to protect his identity, protect his family. And so that had to tear away at him even more so.
Well, and I think his perspective, I think he clearly had gone through a reflection that I thought was very interesting. The idea that when you execute someone and you're using electricity, you're just pushing a button. Mm-hmm. But when you use lethal injection, you are actually putting the liquid, you know, what you're using
the
to
poisons.
Execute them, you're actually putting it into them. I mean, I had never thought of that before. I think that's a real critical part of the story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, of course, as we go on, you know, he talks about Earl Washington.
Yes.
And why don't you talk a little bit about that case, because that's clearly where,
right.
you know.
Earl Washington became Jerry's epiphany. Earl Washington was an inmate that Jerry was scheduled to execute, came within, I think, 9 days of his execution. Prisoners are transferred from one prison to the death house when it's their time to die, and the execution team tends to them for the final 2 weeks of their life, trying to comfort them in a sense, get them ready for their next stage in life. And in this case, in Earl's case, he received a commutation, first from a death sentence to a life sentence. And a little later in time, that life sentence was he was exonerated completely because DNA proved he didn't do it. It took a matter of years for all this to play itself out. But in the interim, it occurred to Jerry, wow, if Earl Washington Jr. is innocent, I wonder if any of the other fellows that I executed were.
And then it shows him going to, wanting to meet Earl, and and actually, I think, in a way, apologizing or saying to him, here, I almost executed you.
That was a scene, the climax of the documentary, that we engineered with both men's approval, consent. The original reason for the commutation for Earl Washington was a low IQ, which, of course, exists to this day. These guys crossed paths 30 years ago on death row. We reunited them. Earl wasn't 100% sure who Jerry was, as Jerry was driving across the state of Virginia to meet with him. Jerry knew darn well who Earl was, and yes, you can see the tears streaming down Jerry's face as we conduct the last interview, and he says, you weren't in my shoes. You don't know what it's like.
Mm-hmm. Well, for the sake of time, I think we need to move on to the other two stories because they're also very impactful.
Sure.
I just want to remind our listeners that you are listening to KKFI FM Community Radio. You're here with Elise Max, Pat Bartholomew, and Rick Stack, who is the co-producer of In the Executioner's Shadow. I just wanted to kind of, before we move on, touch again on the unusual voices that this film amplifies. So we're talking about Jerry Givens, who's a former executioner. And I think I wanted to mention also that in Missouri, we're having an upcoming execution on October 1st of Russell Bucklew. And Jerry Givens and several other former executioners signed an amicus brief for the Supreme Court, pointing out how much trauma is caused by these executions to corrections officers. And in the case of Russell Bucklew, he has a rare genetic disorder, which causes him to have internal and external tumors. Doctors have said that using lethal injection could cause the tumors to explode. They expect he will likely bleed out of his eyes. He's going to choke on his blood during the execution. And he asked for gas. He asked for a stay so Missouri could develop the method of gas to carry out the execution, and that was turned down in April, basically saying that the Eighth Amendment does not guarantee a painless death. And so they kind of want to see what happens with the torture that
it's supposed to guarantee prevent a cruel death.
Correct. Right. Correct. So now the nation will be looking at Missouri on October 1st as to define what is cruel, how much torture can we get away with imposing during these executions. And so we're thankful for Jerry Givens in Missouri, for those unique voices, those corrections officers that are standing up. And I'm kind of curious on if you know if Jerry's been provided counseling, what kind of care or treatment do people that work on the inside get after they've faced, you know, these kinds of events throughout their career?
That's a very good question. While he's employed as a prison guard, I think there's very little support, very little therapy or counseling, if any. I think the only support that these guys get is from each other. There's an execution team of nine men, and I think they share their thoughts, emotions as best they can amongst themselves, and that's the extent of it.
Yeah, I you know, and just before we move on to the other two stories, I believe it was Jerry who mentioned, and I could be wrong, but I seem to remember he was the one that brought up the fact that on the certificate of death, that of course every state has to produce, you know, the cause of death is listed as homicide, and it's something that we who've looked at the death penalty for a long time, I had never thought about that before.
That was a factoid I'd picked up long ago and wanted to have Jerry state this in his own words. When you think, you know, everybody has a birth certificate and eventually everybody has a death certificate. And the cause of death, in this case, you know, the inmates don't die of natural causes. It's not an accident. And so it is listed as a homicide, which is a, human-generated killing.
And that's, as I understand it, that's universal, that every state that has the death penalty uses that as the category of death.
They should. I'm not sure that they all do, but yes.
And Sister Helen Prejean brought it up, and I just happened to see her talking about that, and she said, well, what else would it be?
Yes,
of course
yes.
It's a homicide.
Right.
It's got a place. It's got a date of occurrence. Mm-hmm. It's planned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just think that's really interesting. I wanted to bring that up, but
yes.
Just for the sake of time, let's move on and talk about the other two stories.
Sure,
the
sure.
Second one, of course, again, which is everyone knows this story because of the press that was, you know, that it was so horrifying. That's the Boston Marathon bombing, which was nobody, I think, could believe it. I suspect there's just a huge amount of people. I personally know people that run the Boston Marathon.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so absolutely horrifying.
Shocking.
And I thought this lady was your next protagonist was just so, I give these people credit for their honesty, their willingness to share the kind of agony. You can talk a little bit about her.
Karen is the only of the three main characters. She's the one we did not know beforehand, but we read her quote in the Boston Press, and it was something to this effect. She said, on the one hand, I'd like to strangle Tsarnaev myself. On the other, I have a son the same age, and I really don't want to be a part of someone else losing his life. So she was exceedingly contemplative. She let us follow her thinking in real time over a year and a half, and she waffled. She went back and forth and back and forth, and really, I think, exemplifies the idea that we shouldn't judge anybody's opinion or reaction to tragedy. We all deal with it differently, and in her case, she comes down on the spoiler alert. She comes down on the side of an execution being the right result in Tsarnaev's case. But we asked her, as we did every interviewee in the documentary, "So what is justice?" And she was a bit flabbergasted. She said, "I thought I knew, and when it's in the abstract, I had a strong opinion." But this isn't abstract anymore, and I'm not quite sure what to say.
Right, and I sort of remember her husband kind of came to a different place.
Yes, uh-huh.
By the end of their story.
And they, in a different sort of way than the Shebers, the other protagonists, demonstrate how exacting vengeance doesn't really bring closure,
right.
Doesn't make people feel any better in the short, mid, long run. And yes, she and her husband sort of diverge on how they deal with it, how they cope with it.
Right.
And her husband's really pretty devastated.
The idea that closure is kind of one of those interesting things that we go back and forth. You know, there are people that feel like they do get closure when they, in fact, witness the execution of someone who murdered one of their loved ones, for instance. Mm-hmm. And then there's also people that will say, I don't believe really that you do get closure. What you do is you get a place where you feel like you can deal with it every day, that you learn how to deal with it, is the way one man described the death of his child and then witnessing the execution.
Right. I think closure is a pop psychology term.
Right.
You know, I don't think you can really scientifically categorize it. And again, it's the way different people react to different circumstances.
Right. Just for the sake of time, let's move on to the last story, because that's also, I think, a very, very impactful story.
That story is one of amazing forgiveness. This is Vicky and Sylvester Shieber, the parents of Shannon, who was raped and murdered after her first year of graduate school at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Shannon, from all I could gather, and this is an event that occurred 20 years ago, but the Shiebers were determined at the time of the murder that if and when the perpetrator was caught, and it took 4 years, so they're living in limbo for the first 4 years, whenever that perpetrator was apprehended and the trial began, they were going to be against an execution. They fought to spare the life of their daughter's killer.
Right.
Whenever I utter those words, it sends a little chill down my spine. But theirs is a story of, as I said before, amazing forgiveness based in their Catholicism. They feel like if you ask God for forgiveness, it's incumbent upon you to give forgiveness. And I think, and theirs is a story also, as you follow it over the years, they've become some of the leading advocates in the country to repeal the death penalty. Vicky's testimony in Annapolis was critical to the state of Maryland repealing its death penalty. Maryland became the 18th state. I credit Vicky in large part with that. We now have 21 states that have no longer have the death penalty, and four others that have a governor's moratorium on it. So there's march, there's movement in the right direction. We got to get Missouri on board.
Right, and actually I think one of the pieces that I thought was important, because I think people do have, it's a stepping stone. Like one of the things she did was contact, as I understand it, the mother of the defendant, and had, that's where she really understood, you know, that this was a human being that had committed this murder.
Human being. I think the word to underscore here is humanity. And the thing about the death penalty, the thing about our criminal justice system as it stands, is it eliminates humanity. The humanity of the prison guards who have to carry out the state sanction, the humanity of the victims. We don't really put them front and center. We're really about some sort of severe punishment. So the humanity of the person being punished is also eliminated. Until we bring back humanity, I'm not sure we're going to be able to really move forward in a very meaningful way.
Right. And I think, I think that was, and in fact, she, and I, as I understand it, they have not met this man that committed this murder, that she mentioned that she would like to meet him.
We were hoping to be able to bring a camera to that meeting, if at all possible. Troy Davis is the murderer in this case, and he's not ready to meet with the Shebers. But as you point out, Vicky reached out to the mother of Troy Davis to try to understand who he was.
What really happened.
Right. What the mom's all about, exchanging deep insights into their humanity.
And I think that's when I would say, in almost universally, when people who work with death penalty cases discover that so many people almost universally experience childhood trauma, there's violence, there's assaultive behavior that's perpetuated on the person that committed the murder.
The perpetrators are victims too.
Absolutely.
We've got about 2 minutes left, and I want to bring something up that you mentioned about, you know, 21 states have eliminated the death penalty, four states have moratoriums imposed. We're seeing a change in tide towards states using the death penalty, yet the federal government has reimposed the death penalty after 20 years of hiatus. And we know that eight of those death row inmates in the federal penitentiary are from Missouri. So I just give the last couple minutes here a chance for you to weigh in. What are your feelings about the reimposition of the federal death penalty?
We haven't had a federal execution for 16 years. Timothy McVeigh was the last one. 16 years later, the Trump administration announces we're going to have five executions beginning in December. The skeptic in me, the cynic in me says, "What is this for Christmas? Why December? Why January? Why? Period? Question mark. Those five, the common denominator of the five people that have been slated for execution, that their execution dates have been scheduled. The common denominator is that in each case, among the murder victims, among the victims, is a child, at least one child. So I don't see this as a law enforcement issue. It's not necessarily the worst of the worst. That's misleading language. It's five folks that have included in their victims a child. So as opposed to law enforcement, what I see here is a political ploy by the Trump administration to force Democrats to defend child killers.
Right.
It's a very difficult issue. It's very conflicting, but it's got nothing to do with the administration of justice.
So do you think that the executions will be carried out? I mean, we know there was no comment period on the protocol that changed. So you think it's basically a political ploy without...
I think so. Right. Okay. I think so.
I think we have to wrap up now.
Yep.
I just want to say thank you, Rick Stack, for coming to Kansas City, sharing this very interesting movie. I think the more we watch it, the more insight we're going to gain in the executioner's shadow. Thanks to Elise Max, who's the executive director of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. This is Pat Bartholomew. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Corey's Network invites survivors of murder to their weekly workshops to learn how to deal with grief, the media, police investigations, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. This is a workshop, not a grief group. You should bring something to take notes with, and please include only those individuals mature enough in age to deal with issues being covered during the meeting. The next workshop will be held September 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, Kansas City, Missouri. The church is located east of the Hy-Vee at 40 Highway and Nolan Road. For more information and listing of future workshops, call 816-834-9161 or email coreysnetwork@gmail.com or look for Corey's Network on Facebook. Missouri Cure, Citizens United for Rehabilitation of Errants, will have their 16th annual conference on September 28th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 9669 Bellefontaine Road, St. Louis, Missouri. This year, the theme of the conference is Impact of Incarceration on Women and Children. Sponsored by Mayor Tommy Pearson, this annual conference commemorates 29 years of struggle and advocating for prisoners' rights. No cost, lunch is provided. The Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty is having their annual meeting and abolition conference in Manhattan, Kansas on November 2nd. It's a great opportunity to learn how to make an even greater impact in your work toward ending the Kansas death penalty. Keynote speaker will be the former Kansas Governor John Carlin. As governor of Kansas from 1979 to 87, he vetoed reinstatement legislation four times. Governor Carlin will reflect on the Kansas death penalty and why citizen involvement is key in the effort to abolish it. This event will be November 2nd, 1 to 4 p.m. in the Bluemont Room, Kansas State University Union, second floor, Manhattan, Kansas. Carpooling can be available. Email info@ksabolition.org or call 785-235-2237 and leave a message. My name is Teresa Wilkie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
This is Margo Patterson with the Jaws of Justice. As the drive to cut spending and reduce prison populations grows, more states and communities are using electronic monitoring as a substitute to keeping people in prison or detention. A 2015 study by the Pew Charitable Trust found that the number of people in the criminal justice system who were being supervised with monitors more than doubled in the decade between 2005 and 2015. That trend continues not only in the criminal justice system, but in the U.S. immigration system, which is also increasingly turning to electronic monitoring to track migrants' movements. Join us on the phone from Urbana, Illinois, to talk to us about some of the concerns raised by electronic monitoring is James Kilgore, Project Director of Challenging E-Carceration, a campaign of media justice, a racial justice organizing hub that champions the media and technology rights of communities of color and America's poor. Kilgore is an author, educator, and activist, and a man who has himself worn an electronic monitor. A member of the Symbionese Liberation Army in the 1960s, he lived in Africa for 27 years before being extradited to the United States and serving 6.5 years in prison. In an article published earlier this month on the website Truthout, he discusses having an ankle bracelet slapped on him his first day out of prison and the year he lived wearing it. James Kilgore, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Margot. It's nice to be with you.
A lot of people have the idea that electronic monitoring is a better, kinder alternative to prison. You argue otherwise. Tell us why.
Well, I think it's wrong to think of it as an alternative to incarceration. I think it's an alternative form of incarceration. And I think most people aren't aware of the conditions that generally apply to people who are on electronic monitors, that they're under house arrest, that they typically have to get permission to leave the house for any reason whatsoever, and that this creates huge obstacles for them in terms of trying to find employment, trying to participate in family and community activities, and trying to get on with their life. And I think it's particularly egregious when people are coming out of prison and they've already done all their prison time and they find themselves once again confined, but this time to their house, where they often become quite a burden to their families. I think it's also problematic for people who are released pretrial. They haven't been convicted of anything, but once again, they're being incarcerated and often charged a daily user fee to be on the monitors. So I think there's quite a number of problems that emerge from electronic monitors that people aren't looking at very carefully, and they're simply seeing it as a quick fix, an easy solution to reducing jail and prison populations.
One of the ironies that you and others point out is that even as there seems to be progress being made to end the cash bail system in some states, more states and communities are using electronic monitoring and shifting the cost of that monitoring onto the person being monitored. Fees can run $300 a month. An article in ProPublica notes that ankle monitors often place poor people in particular in special jeopardy, that companies and courts routinely threaten to lock up defendants if they fall behind on payment, and sometimes do. Are reformers in the criminal justice field taking note of this and calling attention to it and asking that this shifting of costs be stopped?
Well, I think it's getting significant attention, but I think the fiscal authorities, that is, you know, local governments and state governments, are always looking for ways to cut their budgets. And clearly, if they take people out of prison and out of jail, they can cut some of their costs by shifting that onto user fees. So for them, it seems like a win-win situation. But, for example, when you take people out of jail pretrial, and part of the argument for that is that they shouldn't be kept in there because they can't afford cash bail, if they wait 6 months or 9 months before their case is actually settled, they can end up paying more money on electronic monitoring fees than they would have had to pay for cash bail in the first place. Similarly, for people coming out of prison who find it very difficult to get a job, and then you want to add $300 a month onto their debt for electronic monitoring fees, it just keeps digging them into a deeper economic hole that's really not going to help them move forward.
You say that, or I think you've written, that poor people, black people, and brown people are being disproportionately affected by electronic monitoring, and that this technology is, quote, automating inequality, end quote, a phrase that comes from the title of a book by Virginia Eubanks on this topic. How are poor people and people of color being targeted by this technology, and is the targeting deliberate, do you think?
I think the targeting really is a result of the systemic racism that's become an integral part of mass incarceration. So I think it's very difficult for any program that functions within the current criminal legal system not to reflect the racial politics of the system as a whole. It's ingrained. So, for example, if we take Cook County in Illinois, which is one of the biggest users of electronic monitoring in the country, we find that about 70% of the people in the jail are black in a city that's 25% black. So if we look at electronic monitoring, what do we find? We find that about 70% of the people on electronic monitoring are black. So it mirrors the racism that exists in the system. And I think another place we see this pretty profoundly is in immigration, where virtually now almost everyone who's not being put into a detention center who's coming across the Mexican border is being put on an electronic monitor. But that's not really the case for people who come in via the airports or through the Canadian border. It's much more haphazard, and clearly the vast majority of the people coming through that southern border are people of color.
Well, on the topic of how the immigration system is using electronic monitoring, I think you mentioned that GPS is tracking some of these migrants. Why is electronic monitoring furnished or equipped with GPS particularly problematic, do you think?
Well, when you're an electronic monitor has GPS tracking, it's basically recording all your locations and storing them somewhere on a cloud, and we really don't have much of an idea of what happens to this data. We do know that the majority of cloud space is owned by four major corporations led by Amazon, but these are companies that have come under a lot of scrutiny for developing a whole kind of surveillance state. So when all of your movements are being tracked, it does two things. First, it does create that permanent record and can connect you to other people who might be in a neighborhood where you go. But secondly, it creates a whole lot of additional restrictions on your movement. It confines you to going to certain areas at certain times. It tracks the time that you leave, the time that you come back, the time that you leave one destination and move to another. And each one of those is a potential, what we call tripwire. That is, each time you're a little bit late, or maybe you're at an address that's next door to the one that they are expecting you to be at, each one of those is a moment where you can be disciplined and be reincarcerated because you violated some small rule about the electronic monitor. So it's very stressful and it's very threatening to have to live under that kind of tight restrictions that's imposed by what we call e-carceration. We call electronic monitoring a form of e-carceration, that is, the use of technology to deprive people of their liberty.
I'm wondering if you would share a little bit about your own experience having to wear an electronic monitor. I know that was some time ago, 10 years or so. What was it like for you?
Well, it was a bit of a shock. You know, I mean, I spent 6.5 years in prison. When I came out, I thought I was going to be pretty free to move around. And what I found was the day after I got home, my parole agent told me I would only be allowed out of the house Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m., which didn't feel too much like freedom to me. I had to get up early just to be able to get out of the house for a couple of hours, and I couldn't go anywhere else, couldn't go anywhere with my family. I had teenage sons. They're not even out of bed before 10 o'clock, so there's no way I'm going to be able to do much with them. I think one of the images that I had from my experience was the first night I went to sleep, I had the image that my parole agent was laying across the foot of the bed underneath the covers looking up at me. And I think that kind of illustrates the way in which having this device on your person and in your house makes you feel like you're dragging the prisoner around you with you, and you're bringing it into your home and creating great sort of tension and stress for your own family members that you really don't want to do. And I think one particular moment that was striking for me was at one point I got a phone call from my mother, who was then 95 years old. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and she lived about a five-minute drive from us, but she said she's had chest pains, thought she was having a heart attack, and had already called 911. Now, obviously, my natural response in that situation would have been to go to her or go to the hospital where they were taking her, but instead I had to go to the 800 number and phone my supervisor and see if I could have permission to leave the house. Well, I just got the call center, and they wouldn't give me permission. They said I had to get permission from my parole agent, and of course at 2 in the morning, he's not going to be available. So I had to make a decision. Am I going to go to the hospital and try to explain it the next morning and run the risk of getting sent back to prison, or am I going to sit in the house and see what happens with my mother and hope that she doesn't pass away between that time and the morning? Fortunately for me, my partner was able to go to the hospital and stay there until 6 a.m. when I had movement. But the next morning I asked my parole agent if in the future I would be able to go to the hospital in such a situation, and he said it's a gray area, which I found pretty scary and didn't reassure me that if it were to happen again, I would in any way be given a pass to go to the hospital. And these are the kinds of situations that many people encounter when they're on a monitor. I think especially parents and mothers with small children who might get sick on short notice and you have to make a decision about whether you're going to take them to the doctor or the hospital and violate your electronic monitoring rules or run the risk of having a health disaster on your hands with your own child.
Well, this is Marco Patterson with Jaws of Justice, and if you're just tuning in, we're talking to James Kilgore, Project Director of Challenging E-Carceration. Jim, I was fascinated to learn that not only are there electronic monitoring devices that speak to the individuals wearing them, some of these devices also listen to what the individuals are saying, which seems a disturbing expansion of surveillance into a person's private life, such that everything that is being said is potentially being listened to and recorded for possible use against them. What, if anything, is being done to defend people's right to privacy in these circumstances?
I think so far, I think we've successfully curbed the uses of those kind of listening devices embedded in electronic monitors. But I think the technology is moving very quickly. And all we have to do is look at our phones and look at these wearable electronic devices and how quickly their capacity to record information and to perform a whole range of functions with all the apps that you can add. I think this is going to end up being part of electronic monitoring in the future. So I think for me what we need to do is we need to start raising the awareness of this. This is all part of a broader kind of surveillance technology, whether it be facial recognition software, whether it be license plate readers. I mean, all this kind of technology that's invading our daily living space and really recording virtually everything that we do and then eventually using it against us. And I think there's a particular way in which this technology impacts poor people, disproportionately people of color, and that is that while people who are fairly comfortable, predominantly white middle-class folks, may worry about someone eavesdropping on their phone calls or reading their emails or even tracking their license plate, for people who are already in the criminal justice system, their name, their information, a lot of data about them is already in the databases, and tracking them and recording more information serves to place far more obstacles in their daily life, may block them from access to housing, to employment, to credit, to a whole range of things that qualitatively affect their life immediately. So I think we need to really be aware of the potential that this technology has to impact the lives of people, particularly the lives of poor people, and try to figure out how we can legislate and how we can educate around this issue before it gets completely out of hand.
Right now, the electronic ankle bracelet seems to be the monitoring device of choice, but it seems from your article that in the brave new world of the future, cell phone apps will be taking over from ankle bracelets. What are some of the apps that are being developed and sold, and do these offer any advantages over the ankle bracelets they are supplanting?
Well, I think these devices are a double-edged sword. I don't think many people really like walking around with this big clunky, I mean, I call it an ankle shackle on their leg. It really stamps them and identifies them as someone who is a so-called criminal. And so embedding the technology into a cell phone at least gets rid of that particular stigma. But what's happening is that these devices are being packaged as support services. So, for example, some of them may have a facility that will remind you when you have a court date or remind you when you have a doctor appointment. Now, that doesn't seem particularly sinister. In fact, it seems like it might be useful. But you have to weigh that up against the fact that it's tracking all this additional information, that it is tracking your doctor appointments, that it probably is recording data about what kind of medical ailments you do have, perhaps what kind of medication you're taking. All of these things are getting stored somewhere in on a cloud in databases that we have no control over. So for me, it's a little bit scary that this technology with all the apps of cell phones are being incorporated now into a sentencing or a pretrial regime without really any ethical or practical debates about it. I think that's the disturbing thing, is we keep rushing ahead with this technology and we don't slow down to say, is this a good idea? What are the pluses and minuses of this? What should we definitely not allow these devices to do? And how do we make sure they don't do that?
Well, you've been alluding to this somewhat, but I want to ask you particularly about a sentence in which you write, quote, "The future of tracking may be about producing criminalized populations and then using the technology to control them, whether it be to regulate the flow of labor across interstate and international borders or to confine individuals with a criminal history to certain parts of the city." Can you, and I think you have been addressing this somewhat, talk about how this is perhaps producing new criminalized populations?
Well, one of the things that GPS tracking does, and I think this is starting to surface now in the very sophisticated tracking technology that's being applied to immigrants, is that not only does it track where you go, but it tracks who you're in communication with. So it builds networks, digital networks of people who are in touch with each other, not simply by their physical location, but also any activity that they have on social media, on their phones, and so forth. So gradually these databases have the ability to connect. I mean, if you're sitting in Louisiana and you have a cousin in Oregon and a cousin in Maine, this technology can connect you to those people in different parts of the country and connect you to all the people that your cousins are in touch with. So all of a sudden we create this big network of folks who have some common point of connection. And if one of those common points of connection happens to be somebody who has a drug conviction or some kind of conviction of a violent crime, then all of a sudden everybody is kind of drawn into this web of guilt. And for me, part of that also is, I mean, I lived in South Africa for 11 years during the transition from apartheid to democracy. And one of the things about the apartheid system was that it controlled the movements of black people in and out of the cities and within the cities. And black people had to carry a passbook, which had to be stamped if they were going into an area that was designated white. Their passbook had to be stamped, and the police often stopped people on the corner, asked them for their passbook. If they didn't have a permit to be where they were, they could go straight to jail. Well, we can certainly program this into people's cell phones or into people's tracking devices now and limit where they can go and where they can't go and find ways to punish them if they violate those rules. That already is applied to people with certain kinds of sex offense convictions or people with alleged gang histories. There's restrictions on their electronic monitor if they go into a part of the city where they're not supposed to be, an alarm sounds. So for me, when we look at how gentrified our cities are, how class and race segregated they're becoming, the technology becomes a way to enforce that and actually to restrict people's movements or to punish them if they go to a place they don't have permission to be. So I think we need to be looking with a bit of imagination in terms of how people might use this technology to both make money and to control populations that they perceive to be problematic or threatening.
Well, you've kind of drawn the connection between electronic monitoring in the surveillance state, and you've written about the difficulty of getting people to organize against this because those concerned about the surveillance state are rarely the same people who are organizing against mass incarceration or ending the cash bail system. Talk to us about what you're doing, what can be done to organize opposition to the expanding use of electronic monitors.
Okay, I think there's a couple of interesting things that are developing. First of all, I think organizations that are connected particularly to the National Bail Fund Network and the Bail Project and the Mama's Bailout, these are organizations that work to eliminate cash bail and to get people out of jail, and they even pay their bails in some cases if they're affordable just to get them out. And they're beginning to look very closely not only at getting people out of jail, but looking at the conditions that are imposed on people when they are released. And there's a growing sentiment within those organizations and those networks against releasing people on electronic monitoring. And people are campaigning about this. They're exposing the problems of electronic monitoring. They're bringing forward the stories of people who have been on electronic monitors as a condition of pretrial release and how, in many ways, being on an electronic monitor mimics the jail. And even because the house arrest can be very severe or the cost can be very severe, it pressures people into accepting plea bargains that they don't really want to accept, but they feel as if they have no choice because they have to end the oppression of the electronic monitor, which is one of the main arguments for getting people out of jail in the first place. A second thing we've done is we've begun to tackle some legislation around electronic monitoring. So we had a bill as challenging e-carceration and a coalition of other groups, including the Shriver Center, Chicago Appleseed. We put forward a bill into the Illinois state legislature to eliminate the use of electronic monitoring for most people coming out of the Illinois Department of Corrections after they'd completed their sentence. We did a lot of effective public education on this bill. We managed to get it to pass the House. It got blocked in the Senate, but we're regrouping and trying to get it through. So it would become the first bill, to our knowledge, in the country that would actually ban the use of electronic monitoring for people who have completed their prison sentence. We also passed a bill in Illinois that compelled the Department of Corrections to file an annual report on the usage of electronic monitoring, because what we found in our FOIAs, our Freedom of Information Act requests from across the country, have found that most jurisdictions keep very little data on electronic monitoring. They don't keep data on a racial breakdown of who's on it. They don't keep records on who's getting sent back to jail or prison for violations. And so we think that's one of the things that we absolutely need to do. So we passed a bill in Illinois that compels the Department of Corrections to file an annual report on electronic monitoring that will include much of this data. So these are just some of the things that are happening. I think there's a lot of increasing awareness about the problems of electronic monitoring, and people are finding ways to challenge it in policy and in legislation, as well as in mobilizing the people who are directly impacted by it.
Well, Mr. Kilgore, one last question. Is electronic monitoring something that you think can be reformed, or is it a practice that you think just needs to be abandoned?
I think in the long run, I mean, I see it as part of mass incarceration. I mean, I'm someone who supports the idea of prison abolition, so I think we need to look at new ways of doing things that eliminate punishment, and I think that electronic monitoring is a form of punishment. So I certainly, having said that, I certainly wouldn't tell someone who's sitting in jail in present circumstances and can't afford the bail, but they're offered the opportunity to come out on an electronic monitor, I certainly wouldn't tell them that they should remain in jail on some abstract principle.
Right.
But I think for those of us who are fighting for change and looking for policies and looking to change the system, that we have to abandon this technology and look for things that are supportive and that are redirecting resources to the communities that have been most impacted.
Mr. Kilgore, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for your work. I really love your radio program, and it's been great talking to you.
Bye-bye. Next up is...
It's the 420 Drug War News. This is a continuation of our coverage of a recent conference in Austin, Texans for Responsible Marijuana. The first person you hear is Mr. John Bockum, president of Republicans Against Marijuana Prohibition.
But previous to Colorado and Washington legalizing cannabis, there was already marijuana crossing the border into Texas, except at that time it was primarily coming from Central and South America up through Mexico and then into Texas. And now we see, because of the legalization in these states, we're seeing California, Washington, Oregon, Colorado. Of course, there's a strong demand for cannabis and cannabis products in Texas where it's still prohibited. An individual can't go to the store and buy a particular strain of cannabis, a particular type of topical or gummies that may be beneficial to them. So yes, of course, you know, that's just supply and demand, that still having a illegal possession laws in Texas is helping to allow strong demand. And of course that product is coming over. So I think, to Aubrey's point, with your hometown in Pueblo, I have a cousin who lives in Pueblo. You know, there were plenty of people who used cannabis previous to legalization, but I certainly understand that there are possibilities for people moving outside the law, having illegal grows, having the cartel industry move into these legal states and start, instead of growing their cannabis in Mexico and shipping it to Texas, now they're growing cannabis in legal states and shipping that to Texas. But the impetus of that, and the real bottom line, is it's the prohibition of cannabis throughout the country and throughout the state of Texas that is supplying those cartel and other kind of criminal enterprise gangs with the funds and resources that they need to continue all sorts of illicit activity, including human trafficking and other things as well. So I think if you were to see Texas legalize cannabis and the rest of the federal law kind of drop at least the Schedule I status of cannabis, you're going to see the price drop dramatically as more market is available, different competitors enter the market. You're already seeing that with hemp. I was at a conference previously, and they talked about, you know, hemp farming going for $3,000 an acre, however many dollars it was, and everybody just sees gold mines and flashing lights, and I'm going to be a hemp farmer with my 1,000 acres. Well, I'll tell you what, when everybody in that room on all their thousands of acres starts growing hemp, that price is going to plummet, and it's not going to be $3,000 an acre anymore. Mm-hmm. You might be lucky if it's $300 or even $3 an acre. So I think you're going to see the same thing with, you know, I don't like the term recreational cannabis, but adult use cannabis, people who are using it in different ways, the price will plummet once a legal playing field is leveled. And then I think you'll see the, you know, profits for these criminal enterprises sort of dry up, and they'll have to pivot to other things which are still illegal and in high demand and create big profits for them.
Again, that was John Bauckham. He's president of Republicans Against Marijuana Prohibition, out there on the web at rampgop.org. Part 6 tomorrow. I'm Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.